Chapter 13. Something there was in Elliot, though, that watched the clock. 10 minutes before his bus was due at the Saw City Candy Kitchen, he thawed, arose, pursed his lips, picked some lint from his suit, went out his office door. He had no surface memory of the fight with his father. His step was jaunty, that of a chaplain-esque boulevardier. He bent to pat the heads of dogs who welcomed him to street level. His new clothes hampered him, bound him in the crotch and armpits, crackled as though lined with newspaper, reminded him of how nicely turned out he was. There was talk coming from the lunchroom. Elliot listened without showing himself. He did not recognize any of the voices, although they belonged to friends of his. 3 men were talking ruefully of money, which they did not have. There were many pauses, for thoughts came to them almost as hard as money did.
"Well," said one at last, "it ain't no disgrace to be poor."
This line was the first half of a fine old joke by the Hoosier humorist Kin Hubbard.
"No," said another man, completing the joke, "but it might as well be."
Elliot crossed the street, went into Fire Chief Charlie Warmergrand's insurance office. Charlie was not a pitiful person, had never applied to the foundation for help of any kind. He was one of about 7 in the county who had actually done quite well under real free enterprise. Bella, of Bella's Beauty Nook, was another. Both of them had started with nothing. Both were children of brakemen on the nickel plate. Charlie was 10 years younger than Elliot. He was 6'4", had broad shoulders, no hips, no belly. In addition to being fire chief, he was federal marshal and inspector of weights and measures. He also owned, jointly with Bella, La Boutique de Paris, which was a nice little haberdashery and notions store in the new shopping center for the well-to-do people in New Ambrosia. Like all real heroes, Charlie had a fatal flaw. He refused to believe that he had gonorrhea, whereas the truth was that he did. Charlie's famous secretary was on an errand. The only other person there when Elliot walked in was Noyes Finnery, who was sweeping the floor. Noyes had been the center of the immortal Noah Rosewater Memorial High School basketball team, which went undefeated in 1933. In 1934, Noyes strangled his 16-year-old wife for notorious infidelity, went to prison for life. Now he was paroled, thanks to Elliot. He was 51. He had no friends, no relatives. Elliot found out about his being in prison by accident, while leafing through old copies of the Rosewater County Clarion Call. Made it his business to get him paroled. Noyes was a quiet, cynical, resentful man. He had never thanked Elliot for anything. Elliot was neither hurt nor startled. He was used to ingratitude. One of his favorite Kilgore Trout books dealt with ingratitude and nothing else. It was called The First District Court of Thank You, which was a court you could take people to if you felt they hadn't been properly grateful for something you had done. If the defendant lost his case, the court gave him a choice between thanking the plaintiff in public or going into solitary confinement on bread and water for a month. According to Trout, 80% of those convicted chose the black hole. Noyes was a lot faster than Charlie in perceiving that Elliot was far from well. He stopped sweeping, watched acutely. He was a mean voyeur. Charlie, enchanted by memories of so many fires at which he and Elliot had behaved so well, did not become suspicious until Elliot congratulated him on having just won an award which he had in fact won 3 years before.
"Elliot, are you kidding?
Why would I kid you? I think it's a wonderful honor." They were discussing the Young Hoosier Horatio Alger Award for 1962, awarded to Charlie by the Indiana Federation of Conservative Young Republican Businessmen's Clubs.
"Elliot," said Charlie wincingly, "that was 3 years ago."
"It was?" Charlie arose from his desk.
"And you and I sat up in your office, and we decided to send the damn plaque back."
"We did?"
"We went over the history of the thing, and we decided it was the kiss of death."
"Why would we decide that?"
"You were the one who dug up the history, Elliot."
Elliot frowned ever so slightly. "I've forgotten." The little frown was a formality. The forgetting didn't really bother him.
"They started giving the thing in 1945. They'd given it 16 times before I won it.
Don't you remember now?
No.
Out of 16 winners of the young Hoosier Horatio Alger Award, 6 were behind bars for fraud or income tax evasion. 4 were under indictment for one thing or another, 2 had falsified their war records, and 1 actually went to the electric chair.
Elliot, said Charlie with mounting anxiety, did you hear what I just said?
Yes, said Elliot.
What did I just say?
I forget.
You just said you heard me.
Noyes Finnery spoke up.
All he hears is the big click.
He came forward for a closer examination of Elliot. His approach was not sympathetic. It was clinical. Elliot's response was clinical, too, as though a nice doctor were shining a bright light in his eyes, looking for something.
He heard that click, man. Man, did he ever hear that click.
What the hell are you talking about? Charlie asked him.
It's a thing you learn to listen for in prison.
We are not in prison now.
It ain't a thing that happens just in prison. In prison, though, you get to listening for things more and more. You stay there long enough, you go blind. You're all ears. The click is one thing you listen for. You two, you think you're mighty close? If you were really close, and that don't mean you have to like him, just know him, you would have heard that click of his a mile away. You get to know a man, and down deep there's something bothering him bad, and maybe you never find out what it is. But it's what makes him do like he does. It's what makes him look like he's got secrets in his eyes. And you tell him, calm down, take it easy now. Or you ask him, how come you keep doing the same crazy things over and over again, when you know they're just going to get you in trouble again? Only you know there's no sense arguing with him, on account of it's the thing inside that's making him go. It says, jump. He jumps. It says, steal, he steals. It says, cry, he cries. Unless he dies young, though, or unless he gets everything all his way and nothing big goes wrong, that thing inside of him is going to run down like a wind-up toy. You're working in the prison laundry next to this man. You've known him 20 years. You're working along, and all of a sudden you hear this click from him. You turn to look at him. He's stopped working. He's all calmed down. He looks real dumb. He looks real sweet. You look in his eyes, and the secrets are gone. He can't even tell you his own name right then. He goes back to work, but he'll never be the same. That thing that bothered him so will never click on again. It's dead. It's dead. And that part of that man's life where he had to be a certain crazy way, that's done.
Noyes, who had begun with such a massive lack of passion, was now rigid and perspiring. Both of his hands were white, choking the broom handle in a death grip. And while the natural design of his story suggested that he calm down to illustrate how nicely the man next to him in the laundry had calmed down, it was impossible for him to simulate peace. The wrenching work his hands did on the broom handle became obscene, and the passion that would not die made him nearly inarticulate.
Gun! Done! He insisted.
It was the broom handle that enraged him most now. He tried to snap it across his thigh, snarled at Charlie, the owner of the broom.
The son of a bitch won't break! Won't break! You lucky bastard, he said to Elliot, still trying to break the broom. You've had yours!
He showered Elliot with obscenities. He flung the broom away.
Motherfucker won't break! He cried.
And he stormed out the door. Elliot was unruffled by the scene. He asked Charlie mildly what the man had against brooms. He said, too, that he guessed he had better catch his bus.
Are you all right, Elliot?
I'm wonderful.
You are?
I never felt better in my life. I feel as though...
Yeah?
As though some marvelous new phase of my life were about to begin.
That must be nice.
It is. It is! And that continued to be Elliot's mood as he sauntered to the Saw City candy kitchen. The aspect of the street was unnaturally quiet, as though a gunfight were expected, but Elliot did not notice this. The town was certain he was leaving forever. Those most dependent on Elliot had heard the click as clearly as they would have heard a cannon shot. There had been a lot of frantic, lame-brained planning of an appropriate farewell, a fireman's parade, a demonstration with placards saying the things that most needed saying, a triumphal arch of water from fire hoses. The plans had all collapsed. There was no one to organize such a thing, to lead. Most were so eviscerated by the prospect of Elliot's leaving that they could not find the energy or bravery to stand at the rear of a large crowd even and feebly wave bye-bye. They knew the street down which he would walk. From that, most fled. Elliot left the afternoon dazzle of the sidewalk for the humid shade of the Parthenon, strolled along the canal. A retired sawmaker, a man about the senator's age, was fishing with a bamboo pole. He was seated on a camp stool. A transistor radio was on the pavement between his high shoes. The radio was playing Ole Man River. "Darkies all work," it said, "while the white folks play." The old man wasn't a drunk or a pervert or anything. He was simply old and a widower and shot full of cancer. And his son in the Strategic Air Command never wrote, and his personality wasn't much. Booze upset him. The Rosewater Foundation had given him a grant for morphine, which his doctor prescribed. Elliot greeted him, found he could not remember his name, nor what his trouble was. Elliot filled his lungs. It was too fine a day for sad things anyway. At the far end of the Parthenon, which was a tenth of a mile long, was a small stand that sold shoelaces, razor blades, soft drinks, and copies of The American Investigator. It was run by a man named Lincoln Evald, who had been an ardent Nazi sympathizer during the Second World War. During that war, Evald had set up a shortwave transmitter in order to tell the Germans what was being produced by the Rosewater Saw Company every day, which was paratroop knives and armor plate. His first message, and the Germans hadn't asked him for any messages at all, was to the effect that if they could bomb Rosewater, the entire American economy would shrivel and die. He didn't ask for money in exchange for the information. He sneered at money, said that that was why he hated America, because money was king. He wanted an iron cross, which he requested be sent in a plain wrapper. His message was received loud and clear on the walkie-talkies of two game wardens in Turkey Run State Park, 42 miles away. The wardens spilled the beans to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who arrested Evald at the address to which the Iron Cross was to be sent. He was put in a mental institution until the war was over. The Foundation had done very little for him, except to listen to his political views, which no one else would do. The only things Elliot ever bought him were a cheap phonograph and a set of German lessons on records. Evald wanted so much to learn German, but he was too excited and angry all the time. Elliot couldn't remember Evald's name either, and nearly passed him by without seeing him. His sinister little leper's booth there in the ruin of a great civilization was easy to miss.
"Heil Hitler," said Evald in a grackle voice.
Elliot stopped, looked amiably at the place from which the greeting had come. Evald's booth was curtained by copies of The American Investigator. The curtains seemed to be polka-dotted. The polka dots were the belly buttons of Randy Harold, the cover girl, and she asked over and over again for a man who could give her a baby that would be a genius.
"Heil Hitler," said Evald again.
He did not part the curtains.
"And Heil Hitler to you, sir," said Elliot, smiling. "And goodbye."
The barbaric sunshine slammed Elliot as he stepped from the Parthenon. His momentarily injured eyes saw two loafers on the courthouse steps as charred stickmen surrounded by steam. He heard Bella, down in her beauty nook, bawling out a woman for not taking good care of her fingernails. Elliot encountered no one for quite a while, although he did catch someone peeking at him from a window. He winked and waved to whomever it was. When he reached Noah Rosewater Memorial High School, which was closed tight for the summer, he paused before the flagpole, indulged himself in shallow melancholy. He was taken by the sounds of the hollow iron poles being tapped and caressed despondently by the hardware on the empty halyard. He wanted to comment on the sounds, to have someone else listen to them too. But there was nobody around but a dog that had been following him, so he spoke to the dog.
"That's such an American sound, you know. School out and the flag down.
Such a sad American sound. You should hear it sometime when the sun's gone down and a light evening wind comes up, and it's supper time all around the world. A lump grew in his throat. It felt good. As Elliot passed the Sunoco station, a young man crept from between two pumps. He was Roland Berry, who had suffered a nervous breakdown 10 minutes after being sworn into the Army at Fort Benjamin Harrison. He had a 100% disability pension. His breakdown came when he was ordered to take a shower with 100 other men. The pension was no joke. Roland could not speak above a whisper. He spent many hours a day between the pumps, pretending to strangers that he had something to do with something there.
"Mr. Rosewater," he whispered.
Elliot smiled, held out his hand. "You'll have to forgive me. I've forgotten your name." Roland's self-esteem was so low that he was not surprised at being forgotten by a man whom he had visited at least once a day for the past year.
"Wanted to thank you for saving my life."
"For what?"
"My life, Mr. Rosewater. You saved it, whatever it is."
"You're exaggerating, surely."
"You're the only one who didn't think what happened to me was funny. Maybe you won't think a poem is funny either."
He thrust a piece of paper into Elliot's hand.
"I cried while I wrote it. That's how funny it was to me. That's how funny everything is to me."
He ran away. Perplexed, Elliot read the poem, which went like this.
"Lakes, carolinst, pools and bells, fifes and freshets, harps and wells, flutes and rivers, streams, bassoons, geysers, trumpets, chimes, lagoons. Hear the music, drink the water, as we poor lambs all go to slaughter. I love you, Elliot. Goodbye, I cry. Tears and violins, hearts and flowers, flowers and tears. Rosewater, goodbye."
Elliot arrived at the Saw City Candy Kitchen without further incident. Only the proprietor and one customer were inside. The customer was a 14-year-old nymphette, pregnant by her stepfather, which stepfather was in prison now. The foundation was paying for her medical care. It had also reported the stepfather's crime to the police, had subsequently hired for him the best Indiana lawyer that money could buy. The girl's name was Tawny Wainwright. When she brought her troubles to Elliot, he asked her how her spirits were.
"Well," she said, "I guess I don't feel too bad. I guess this is as good a way as any to start out being a movie star."
She was drinking a Coca-Cola and reading the American Investigator now. She glanced furtively at Elliot once. That was the last time.
"A ticket to Indianapolis, please."
"One way or round trip, Elliot?"
Elliot did not hesitate.
"One way, if you please."
Tawny's glass nearly toppled. She caught it in time.
"One way to Indianapolis," said the proprietor loudly. "Here you are, sir."
He validated Elliot's ticket with a stamp savagely, handed over the ticket, turned quickly away. He didn't look at Elliot again either. Elliot, unaware of any strain, drifted over to the magazine and book racks for something to read on the trip. He was tempted by the Investigator, opened it, scanned a story about a 7-year-old girl who had had her head eaten off by a bear in Yellowstone Park in 1934. He returned it to the rack, selected instead a paperback book by Kilgore Trout. It was called Pangalactic 3-Day Pass. The bus blew its flatulent horns outside. As Elliot boarded the bus, Diana Moon Glampers appeared. She was sobbing. She was carrying her white princess telephone, dragging its uprooted wire behind her.
"Mr. Rosewater?"
"Yes?"
She smashed the telephone on the pavement by the door of the bus.
"I don't need a telephone anymore. Nobody for me to call up. Nobody to call me up."
He sympathized with her, but he did not recognize her.
I'm sorry. I don't understand."
"You don't what?" "It's me, Mr. Rosewater. It's Diana. It's Diana Moon Glampers."
"I'm pleased to meet you."
"Pleased to meet me?"
I really am, but what's this about a telephone?
You were the only reason I needed one.
Oh, now, he said doubtingly. You surely have many other acquaintances.
Oh, Mr. Rosewater,
she sobbed, and she sagged against the bus.
You're my only friend.
You can make more, surely, Elliot suggested hopefully.
Oh, God,
she cried. You could join some church group, perhaps.
You're my church group. You're my everything. You're my government. You're my husband. You're my friends.
These claims made Elliot uncomfortable. You're very nice to say so. Good luck to you. I really have to be going now. He waved. Goodbye. Elliot now began to read Pan-Galactic 3-Day Pass. There was more fussing outside the bus, but Elliot didn't think it had anything to do with him. He was immediately enchanted by the book, so much so that he didn't even notice when the bus pulled away. It was an exciting story, all about a man who was serving on a sort of space-age Lewis and Clark expedition. The hero's name was Sergeant Raymond Boyle. The expedition had reached what appeared to be the absolute and final rim of the universe. There didn't seem to be anything beyond the solar system they were in, and they were setting up equipment to sense the faintest signals that might be coming from the slightest anything in all that black velvet nothing out there. Sergeant Boyle was an Earthling. He was the only Earthling on the expedition. In fact, he was the only creature from the Milky Way. The other members were from all over the place. The expedition was a joint effort supported by about 200 galaxies. Boyle wasn't a technician. He was an English teacher. The thing was that Earth was the only place in the whole known universe where language was used. It was a unique Earthling invention. Everybody else used mental telepathy, so Earthlings could get pretty good jobs as language teachers just about anywhere they went. The reason creatures wanted to use language instead of mental telepathy was that they found out they could get so much more done with language. Language made them so much more active. Mental telepathy, with everybody constantly telling everybody everything, produced a sort of generalized indifference to all information. But language, with its slow, narrow meanings, made it possible to think about one thing at a time, to start thinking in terms of projects. Boyle was called out of his English class, was told to report at once to the commanding officer of the expedition. He couldn't imagine what it was all about. He went into the CO's office, saluted the old man. Actually, the CO didn't look anything like an old man. He was from the planet Tralf Mador, and was about as tall as an Earthling beer can. Actually, he didn't look like a beer can either. He looked like a little plumber's friend. He wasn't alone. The chaplain of the expedition was there, too. The Padre was from the planet Klinko X-3. He was an enormous sort of Portuguese man-o-war, in a tank of sulfuric acid on wheels. The chaplain looked grave. Something awful had happened. The chaplain told Boyle to be brave, and then the CO told him there was very bad news from home. The CO said there had been a death back home, that Boyle was being given an emergency 3-day pass, that he should get ready to leave right away.
Is it, Mom? Said Boyle, fighting back the tears. Is it Pop? Is it Nancy?
Nancy was the girl next door.
Is it Gramps?
Son, said the CO, brace yourself. I hate to tell you this. It isn't who has died, it's what has died.
What's died?
What's died, my boy, is the Milky Way.
Elliot looked up from his reading. Rosewater County was gone. He did not miss it. When the bus stopped in Nashville, Indiana, the seat of Brown County, Elliot glanced up again, studied the fire apparatus on view there. He thought of buying Nashville some really nice equipment, but decided against it. He didn't think the people would take good care of it. Nashville was an arts and crafts center, so it wasn't surprising that Elliot also saw a glassblower making Christmas tree ornaments in June. Elliot didn't look up again until the bus reached the outskirts of Indianapolis. He was astonished to see that the entire city was being consumed by a firestorm. He had never seen a firestorm, but he had certainly read and dreamed about many of them. He had a book hidden in his office, and it was a mystery even to Elliot as to why he should hide it, why he should feel guilty every time he got it out, why he should be afraid of being caught reading it. His feelings about the book were those of a weak-willed Puritan with respect to pornography, yet no book could be more innocent of eroticism than the book he hid. It was called The Bombing of Germany. It was written by Hans Rumpf. And the passage Elliot would read over and over again, his features blank, his palms sweating, was this description of the firestorms in Dresden. As the many fires broke through the roofs of the burning buildings, a column of heated air rose more than 2.5 miles high and 1.5 miles in diameter. This column was turbulent, and it was fed from its base by inrushing cooler ground surface air. 1.5 miles from the fires, this draft increased the wind velocity from 11 to 33 miles per hour. At the edge of the area, the velocities must have been appreciably greater, as trees 3 feet in diameter were uprooted. In a short time, the temperature reached ignition point for all combustibles, and the entire area was ablaze. In such fires, complete burnout occurred, that is, no trace of combustible material remained, and only after 2 days were the areas cool enough to approach. Elliot, rising from his seat in the bus, beheld the firestorm of Indianapolis. He was awed by the majesty of the column of fire, which was at least 8 miles in diameter and 50 miles high. The boundaries of the column seemed absolutely sharp and unwavering, as though made of glass. Within the boundaries, helixes of dull red embers turned in stately harmony about an inner core of white. The white seemed holy.